Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Cybersecurity is top of mind, whether you lead a company or a government. The risk of cyber attack is ever present. Experts say the question is not whether such an attack would occur, but when. And the key, they say, is to be able to ride it out and rebound swiftly. In this week's episode, we'll hear from New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. He is the author of the compelling new book entitled The Perfect Weapon. Moderating the program is Marcus Kounoulakis, my co-host and visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Marcus and David Sanger.
It's my great pleasure to be here with David Sanger, and he joins us this evening to discuss various uses of cyber weapons and how great and small powers are affected. He has been in Washington, D.C. many years as a White House correspondent and now as the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. But he's also been a foreign correspondent. So he's been able to observe American foreign policy both at home and abroad. And I thought before we get into the guts of this new book that you've written, The Perfect Weapon, and look at cyber warfare as a new regime that we're now facing in the world, I thought maybe we would just take a little bit of an overview and sort of get the state of play, as it were, of our foreign policy and where the United States is relative to other nations. And I'll just set it up by saying, you know, the last president was characterized as having, President Obama, a foreign policy that was don't do stupid stuff. Mm-hmm. Recently, we heard that President Trump's is, we're America, don't mess with us, to put it nicely.
You've cleaned up both of those.
I did. I'm not going to use invective. But is there a Trump doctrine now? And you're, as I say, in the heart of Washington, D.C., and you're able to observe this from perhaps the most important perch in our media environment.
Well, first of all, thank you. Thank you, Marcus, for doing this. Thank all of you on the beautiful and longest night of the year to come and spend your time hearing about the Trump administration, about cyber weapons, all of that. The only cheery news I can give you out of this is it will still be light out when you walk out this door.
Okay.
So we're beginning to get a sense of what a Trump doctrine looks like. For a lot of presidents, there is a thought that goes into what is the doctrine itself. And you know, in the Obama years, his very cautious approach to the world and what people called leading from behind was basically an effort to say our strength is in our alliances, that we don't have to be out solving every single problem, but that we want to make sure that our moral force is guiding those who do. So, the main critique, and the one of the critiques that I think won the presidency for Donald Trump, was that this was too cautious, that while Trump shared the Obama instinct that we were in too many places in the world and stretched too thin and spending too much money in places like Afghanistan instead of spending that here at home, the difference is that President Trump simultaneously wants to pull back American forces from almost every place. When I did the foreign policy interviews with him with Maggie Haberman during the campaign, it was dominated by the discussion of the areas where he wanted to shrink the American footprint, right? Let Japan and South Korea get their own nuclear weapons so that our nuclear deterrent didn't have to be there, pull back our troops from Japan and South Korea, and from NATO, because why should we be paying for somebody else's defense, and so forth. So that was part one. But the difference with Obama is that he then feels that the U.S. should lash out in defense of its own interests over and above the interests of close allies. So the fundamental calculus that Obama made, which is we are stronger when we build our alliances, has given way to a Trump doctrine, which is alliances aren't all that worth all that they're cracked up to be. And instead, we should go focus on what's good in any given transaction. And you end up with a very transactional foreign policy, a foreign policy that is judged very much by how have I done in this one instance, rather than the assumption that we made that was constant through the Obama years, the Bush years, the Clinton years, and many presidents before, which is you build up alliances to save for a rainy day. The world's a big, tough, nasty place. You don't know when you're going to need your allies. So we're not going to measure each transaction according to whether we won or lost today. We're not going to do an inning-by-inning box score because we're playing the long game here, and moments like 9/11 come up, and moments come up in world trade, and moments come up in information technology. You need your friends for things you can't anticipate today. President Trump fundamentally does not think like that. He does not think in alliance terms. And when I've talked to people who've worked with him over many years and asked them, why is that? Why is it that he doesn't think in terms of alliances the way many of us went to school to go learn about? They said, well, you know, his experience is as a real estate developer. And you move from transaction to transaction, and you are building up your own wealth, your own scorecard. And the people who you're building your building with in New York are probably different than the building people who are building your building in Paris, and probably different from the ones who are you're building with in Moscow. Oh, sorry about that. You didn't build in Moscow. There was no relationship with the Russians. Now, we now know that he was trying to build in Moscow and failed. So that's the fundamental difference, that he basically says, you're going to do this for our benefit. And if it's not in our benefit, you can go away. So then that leads to the very odd moments like we had last week, where he gets into a huge fight with Justin Trudeau over softwood lumber, and then goes off to praise the leader of North Korea in Singapore days later because he's an incredibly strong leader. And that leads to one last thing, which is democratic allies mean less to him than strength as a leader, which explains how it is that he prefers to deal with Duterte in the Philippines or deal with Vladimir Putin, or deal with any strong leader, including Kim Jong-un, over these sort of weak-kneed liberal Democrats who don't have ultimate power because they've got to deal with the domestic politics of their own countries.
That's a lot to unpack. And it's and because it is such a different approach, and it's different not just from the last administration, but from administrations in the past, where, in fact, values have played a certain role. And what you're saying, in essence, is while the last administration may have been concerned about free riders to some degree overseas, our allies, there was a values-led foreign policy that also focused on interests. It sounds as if values are out the window. It's all about interests.
Pretty much is. I mean, at one point during, it was a remarkable press conference in Singapore, wound all over the place, went for more than an hour. And at one point, a reporter stood up and she said to the president, I'd like to hear about your discussions with Kim Jong-un about the human rights situation in North Korea. And I'd like to know how you could praise him for his strength and said that you learned that he loves his people when so many of his people are sitting in gulags. And he basically went on to praise Kim Jong-un's strength. and said, yeah, we made a brief reference to human rights. And I think that's because somebody puts in the notes there, be sure you raise human rights, even if just glancingly, so you can come out and say later that you raised human rights. Mm-hmm. Now, all administrations have done that, but this one's doing it with a real fervor. They do care about human rights when they can beat up on the Iranians, but you didn't hear much discussion of it in, say, the case of North Korea. So this has not been values-led by any means. And I think the big question of the Trump presidency is, if you wander too far from American values as you are representing the country, do you hit a moment where you have undercut your credibility with your allies and here at home? And what's, I think, remarkable right now at this sort of moment in history is that his party, the Republican Party, which started up in opposition to slavery, obviously, and which moved on to represent democratic values under a series of presidents, I would say the high point sort of being George H.W. Bush as he brought together the former Soviet states and began to bring them into NATO and into the West. Is their core more like George H.W. Bush, or is it more like Donald Trump? Because you don't hear many of them. You hear some, but you don't hear many of them urging a return to a values-based system.
And really what we need to do is wait for the next couple of elections to see if the electorate is pushing them in either towards either camp. And that will be, of course, this November 1st. Perhaps more of a reaction rather than a statement on ideology. But by 2020, I would think that those camps will have to establish themselves in a much more aggressive and assertive way.
If they're not, then something has gone seriously and maybe permanently haywire in the way our system operates. Look, there's always a values interests element to this, and if you read the New Yorker review of Ben Rhodes' recent memoir of his time in the White House, there's an interesting moment where President Obama, says, look, I'm not going to go into Syria. I may do brief pinprick bombing, but I'm not going to get us involved there. And there are a lot of, values-based journalists wandering around in Washington and New York. In fact, he named Nick Kristof, my colleague at the Times, a columnist. He said, who aren't going to like that? And that's tough luck. And that was Obama the pragmatist stepping out over Obama the idealist. Donald Trump doesn't spend a lot of time trying to convince people that there's the idealist side of him.
Right. And all this, of course, in the context, and this will bring us to really your book, in the context of where the United States is in this current 21st century, early 21st century reality, which is with a rising China, a Russia that is seen as a competitor and actually an adversary, if you read the national security strategy, and a president who's untested in many ways, who's figured out how to break a lot of deals, not make so many deals. And the question is, are we looking at an America which is, and I think the president has represented it as such, that has been in decline, and if so, versus these other nations?
So it's all a question of how you measure decline. Mm-hmm. By any economic measure, which is the main one that Donald Trump would use, we're doing pretty spectacularly. I mean, we've had an expansion underway here that under previous models should have begun to slow down some time ago, and it's still going strong. It will hit the wall eventually, but the expansion has been considerable. And if you look by the measure that many people here in San Francisco will offer, which is who is the innovation leader in the world, we're still way out ahead in that. And, I heard a lot about American decline in the 6 years that I was the Times correspondent in Japan. Andy Grove, who just died a year or two ago, but was one of the founders of Intel, and an absolutely brilliant force in technology and business and international politics, used to talk about whether or not the United States would become a techno-colony of Japan, because we saw ourselves in decline and believed that Japan was about to go take over the world. Well, that turned out to be a pretty bad bet. We're now doing the same thing in regards to China, and I think China is a significantly more potent challenger over the next half decade two decades, and certainly over the next 100, than Japan ever was. The place where we are in decline, I think, is in our moral leadership of the world, of the U.S. as a beacon that you would want to come go replicate. Now, I wouldn't overestimate that. You go talk to students around the world about where it is they want to come study, and they are lined up at American embassies around the world to get a student visa here. And actually, I think one of America's greatest strengths to this moment, and the one that we underutilize, is the appeal of our universities. And it's wrapped up in our immigration problems. I mean, my view is, if a foreign student comes here, goes through graduate school, becomes an expert in an area of technology that we think is useful to the American economy, you should staple a green card to their diploma, okay? And keep them here for as long. I mean, at some point, they're going to want to go home, and that's fine, because our thought is that when they go home, they bring American values back with them. But we don't want to be investing in their education and then losing all the benefit of it right away. But that is not the current American mindset.
So I'm always happy to hear this because I sit on the Fulbright board, and so I'm...
Bless you, you are doing more of that. See how that... Try float that staple the green card line to the Trump administration the next time you get there and see how far it gets
I'll
you.
I'll bring that up with Secretary Pompeo and see what he has to say. So I appreciate how you've framed the decline question. And as we look at American power, as you say, it's relative. It's what you look at and how you measure it. But your book, The Perfect Weapon, and really talks about the great leveler of the contemporary era. And you do a great job of sort of looking at the evolution of technology and its import in warfare. And you bring us to today. And you essentially point out, with these new tools that are being developed, the cyber tools that we all are familiar with, that we read about regularly in your your articles and elsewhere, that in essence, it is a weapon that is currently being used on a daily basis. It is one that does not require a superpower, per se, to be able to develop or deploy. And it is changing the nature of how we are engaging with adversaries and allies alike. And it is a spectacular book. I recommend it highly. I have not finished it yet, but I am certainly...
It only came out Tuesday. You're fine.
That's right.
Tuesday, however.
Yes,
you know,
no,
right.
It's an impressive work because, in many ways, what David does is he looks at, for example, how nuclear weapons changed the world, how it changed strategy, how it changed the relationship of the United States to other nations, and how it made, for instance, North Korea today able to bring the United States to the table, to the negotiating table. It is a very powerful tool and weapon. Cyber, however, does not quite have the doctrines that we've developed over time. And so what David talks about in this book is all of these things, the use of cyber warfare, the ability for us to come to some level of understanding and maybe even a cyber START treaty of some sort. And he's done a deep dive into it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, sort of give us the overview of what it is you're looking at and how you define these things.
Well, I'm glad you used the cyber nuclear comparison, because while it's very tempting, because we all say, well, we came up with a way to deter nuclear attacks, why can't we do the same in cyber? That was similarly the development of a weapon that started in the United States and that we used right off. Cyber is really the product of American innovation, but have obviously spread elsewhere. But it's one of those cases that can be kind of a false analogy, and you have to be really careful when you go use these. Why is that? Well, here we are more than half a century, well more than half a century after the first use of a nuclear weapon. There are only 9 countries in the world right now that still have that have nuclear weapons, the 5 declared nuclear powers, and then India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. President Kennedy thought in 1962 that within 10 or 15 years there would be 60 or 70 nuclear powers. He had the number right, but he had it right for cyber. Mm-hmm. The barrier to entry to cyber is very low. The barrier to entry for nuclear is very high. You either have the plutonium and the uranium and the big expensive facilities to go deal with it, or you don't. There's no halfway about it. In cyber, you just need some bright talent, some laptops, some computing and coding skill, and a lot of caffeine, okay? And so, and you know, Red Bull isn't that expensive compared to plutonium and uranium. So it is entirely within the reach of even the poorest countries to get a hold of this weapon. But not only that, it's a weapon that you can dial up and dial down. Nuclear has an on-off switch. And so if the North Koreans, God forbid, ever did use a nuclear weapon against us or one of our allies, they'd probably feel really good about it for about 45 minutes. And that would then be their last set of memories, right? And that's what's made the deterrence work here, that there's an understanding that if you use that weapon, your regime is gone and your people are gone. Cyber, on the other hand, because it is nowhere near as powerful in the first instance as nuclear, you can use every single day in the most targeted, narrow way you want. And I take people through some of that history from the last book I wrote, which was Confront and Conceal, which revealed the story behind how two presidents had put together an operation called Olympic Games, which was the first major use of a cyber weapon of one state against another. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, against Iran's nuclear program. At the time that I wrote Confront and Conceal, only 6 years ago, it was hard to find another sophisticated state-on-state cyber attack. If I listed them for you now, we would burn the rest of the hour. And it's just in the past 5 or 6 years, the Iranians against the Saudis and Saudi Aramco, the Iranians against our banks, the Iranians against our dams, the Russians against our election system, the Russians against the White House, the State Department, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Chinese against just about everybody they wanted to steal information against, us against the North Koreans, the North Koreans against Sony, the North Koreans against the British healthcare system almost by accident through the WannaCry attack, the North Koreans against central banks that they wanted to rob. There's a big, long list, and it's a continuum. You know, we tend to think of nuclear just out at, you know, the big mushroom cloud. But in cyber, you can use it for espionage. You can use it for data manipulation. Supposing we got into the military's database and changed everybody's blood type. Imagine the chaos that would cause. Or hospitals and changed everybody's blood type. You can use it against physical facilities. That's the cyber Pearl Harbor concern. And yet most Americans do not think of cyber in this kind of continuum way, the way we think of, you know, we've got guns, automatic weapons, you know, tanks, missiles, nuclear weapons. We're thinking of those on a continuum. But we lose track of the fact that when you're seeing cyber attacks happen, even the ones that affect you, you are pretty much the collateral damage in a cyber war that's going on 30,000 feet above you.
It's interesting that you talk about this spectrum because as this cyber war is ongoing, we know certainly in California that Sony was attacked, we're told by the U.S. government, by the North Koreans. The question in warfare that always arises when you are engaged in some attack is escalation and deterrence. And these guns and then automatic weapons and tanks can eventually get engaged if a nation decides to do so. But it seems that we, the United States, have not decided to retaliate or to escalate. I mean, we've threatened it, but has there been any announced escalation or retaliation for some of the attacks that we've had in the past?
There has been, but they've been in very limited ways because most of these have not been what we would typically consider to be acts of war. They have been short of war. So look at the Sony case because it's a really interesting example. It was one of the first big political hacks that happened against the United States. Political because the North Koreans were trying to keep Sony from distributing a movie that posited that a couple of journalists who were being sent in to interview Kim Jong-un would be tasked by the CIA to kill him. This is the same smiling Kim Jong-un who was I saw out at the nightclubs in Singapore last week when we were all out there. So a couple of things that are crazy about this scenario. First of all, having been around journalists for 35 years, if you're going to hire a group of hitmen, I would suggest starting with a different profession. And I think Marcus, having spent so much time in journalism here, would probably agree with that. Secondly, it was a truly terrible movie. Okay, so I'm gonna save 2 hours of your life right now by suggesting that, you know, read the book instead of downloading the movie. But when the North Koreans came to the moment of trying to stop this, they did the first thing you'd all do when you wanted to stop a movie, which is they wrote a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations because we all know what influence he has in Hollywood. And when that didn't go very far, they very patiently got into the Sony computer systems in September of 2014. And they didn't just get in and attack right away. They did what good cyber warriors do. They hid themselves. They mapped the system. They spent months studying how Sony's computer systems connected together. They didn't attack until Thanksgiving. And when that moment came, you know, we all think of the part of this that you remember, which was that they made public a lot of Sony emails. What's that foreshadow, right? And from these, we learned vital facts like directors consider Angelina Jolie to be difficult to work with on the set. But the real import of the hack was that they destroyed 70% of Sony Pictures' computer systems. And for that, the only penalty they paid was a small group of sanctions that President Obama eventually put on them that I bet they never felt compared to all the other sanctions on North Korea. Now, just do the thought experiment for a second, Mark. Supposing that cyber didn't exist, and the only way that North Korea could get at Sony was to land a bunch of commandos at Long Beach and have them call an Uber and have them go up to Sony Studios, probably remarking to each other they didn't realize there were this many cars in the world. And when they finally get there, they join the Sony studio tour and they stick some dynamite underneath the computer system and they run like hell. And we see the studio computer center in flames on CNN. No matter who was president, Democrat, Republican, I would bet that they would feel forced to make something blow up in Pyongyang. But because this was a cyber attack, and there was no obvious flames on CNN, they could do much less. So then along comes the Russia hack, and what happens? The Russians hack into all those different American institutions I named before, and they got nothing. The Obama administration didn't even name Russia as the suspect, because they said, well, everybody does espionage. And what lesson does Vladimir Putin draw from that? If they're not going to defend the White House, where the Russians were stealing unclassified emails, who's going to give a about the DNC, which is basically a shoestring operation run by a bunch of college kids? And he was right.
Which means that there is effectively no deterrence.
So the best way to get deterrence is deterrence by denial, which is to say, the deterrence that would come from saying, it's not worth it, my defenses are so good, you're never going to get through anyway. That's why banks put their vaults deep underground and make it really hard to break in, like, don't bother. The problem is, in the digital world, that while our defenses have gotten better, particularly in the finance industry and the utilities, the attack surface has expanded every single year. The Alexa in your kitchen, your internet-connected car, your internet-connected refrigerator. Why your refrigerator needs to be internet-connected, I do not understand, but it is, right? Every single sensor, the alarm system in your house, the video cameras in your house or around your house, each one of these provides a way for somebody to get in, and we have expanded the target set much faster than we have improved our defenses.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from David Sanger, national security correspondent at the New York Times and author of the new book, The Perfect Weapon. He's in conversation with my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel. Search for World Affairs, one word. And now back to Marcus Kounoulakis and David Sanger.
You know, it seems that so we're opening it up to some of the questions here, and I've got a number of them from a very large audience here this evening who all seem to be concerned about some of these issues, as well as foreign policy in general. But here's a question that says, what are the prospects for a multilateral agreement or policing of cyber weapons? And though time-consuming, wouldn't such discussions foment better understanding and mitigate risk of cyber war?
Well, there have been a lot of people who have sort of looked at this. There's a UN group of experts that has looked at it. Joe Nye has done some really fascinating writing on this topic, professor at Harvard who taught me, and has written a lot on it. I think the more people have looked at it, the more people have come to the conclusion this is not a place for treaties. Why? Well, first of all, the weapons aren't just in the hands of states. They're in the hands of criminals. They're in the hands of terror groups. They're in the hands of teenagers. I don't know about in your household, Marcus, but in my household, the teenagers don't sign treaties. So second, the technology is moving so quickly that by the time you negotiated the treaty, and certainly by the time you got it through the Senate and its equivalents elsewhere, it would be a useless document. And the third problem that you run into it is, let's say we had some things we were willing to say should be off limits. An election system, the electoral grid, the electricity grid. Emergency services, you don't want people attacking hospitals or your 911 system and so forth. Probably things we could all agree. If we sat down and made a list here, I bet in 10 minutes we could come up with a group of humanitarian-related targets or democracy-related targets that we would say should be off limits. So then you get ready to go suggest that everybody agree these are off limits. and you hold your interagency meeting in Washington, which is most of what people do in Washington. And in walks the intelligence community. You're going to make election systems off limits? Did you guys not get the memo about what we did in Italy in the 40s and Latin America in the 60s? You know? You're going to make power systems off limits? Go read Sanger's book. There's a description about something called Nitro Zeus. That was a secret program the United States had a few years ago to unplug all of Iran if we got into a big conflict with Iran before the 2015 nuclear agreement was signed. You want the CIA and the NSA to agree that we will never put implants in a country's computer systems so that we can unplug them? What do you want, unilateral disarmament? Mm-hmm. You would never get agreement inside Washington about giving that up.
And a part of getting to any kind of understanding is, and you talk about this in the book as well, is making clear what your capacities and your capabilities are. Not necessarily unilaterally disarm, but certainly to say to our adversaries and others, this is what we're capable of in a broad sense, so that that itself would function as a deterrent. But you say that, as you just said, you're bumping up against institutions that are privileging secrecy, that are not interested in giving up their capabilities, and we yet don't have the ability to even have that conversation in any reasonable way with the rest of the world.
That's right, we don't. And part of that is that cyber is one of the first weapons to have come up really as weaponry designed by the intelligence community. And the intelligence community is naturally secretive. And so we actually have more secrecy surrounding our cyber arsenal than we did around our nuclear arsenal. And if you think about it, during the Cold War, all the details of how nuclear weapons operated were secret, you know, how to build them, where we store them, who's got authority to launch them. But fundamentally, the numbers of them we had, the times in which the conditions under which we'd use them, that was all publicly debated. And we ended up in a very different place than we started. You know, we started with MacArthur wanting to use nuclear weapons against the North Koreans and the Chinese, and we ended up 20 or 30 years later agreeing that we would never use nuclear weapons except as a matter of national survival. Mm-hmm. We have never had that debate about cyber, and we've got a lot of people who don't want us to have that debate about cyber because, as I said before, we use it every day, and of course people use it against us every day. I don't think you're going to get to this discussion we need, forget treaties, just about some norms of behavior, something more akin to what Brad Smith has suggested, the president of Microsoft, as a sort of Geneva Convention. It's a set of values of, you know, what you would do on the battlefield or in times before you were in war, until we actually have an honest discussion about what our capabilities are.
So we have a number of other questions here, and because it's something you talked about, which is implants, and it's not necessarily something we have in our bodies, but something that we have in our computer systems and on our networks. And one of the questions here is, in your current estimation, what kind of and how much impact could foreign implants cause in the American infrastructure? And I guess we're talking in this instance about the electric grid and any number of other fundamental pieces of American infrastructure.
Well, let's reach back into ancient history, say about 3 months ago, when the Department of Homeland Security turned out a warning that a pretty well-known piece of Russian malware was all through our utility grid. Now, the utilities have known about this since at least last summer and some of them before that. But the effort was to warn that this malware is there. And, you know, as we wrote a story on it that was on the front page of the New York Times, and when I went to look a day later, we had like 2 million readers come to this thing because it plays to this American fear that as soon as the implant is there, they're ready to go switch the power off. Now, I have my doubts about whether they're willing to go do that, because I think they know that that's one of the steps that could lead to a military retaliation. But it's interesting that when we see foreign implants in our system, our minds immediately go to the worst-case scenario. And when we put implants in foreign systems, and we have put them in tens, if not hundreds of thousands of cases in foreign networks, we say, oh, we're just conducting surveillance, or, oh, we are preparing the battlefield in case we ever need to do it. But don't worry about it, because everybody knows our intent is benign out here. And we're somehow going to have to get around this cognitive dissonance between what we're intending when we do it and what we assume our adversaries are intending.
Right. You know, when I read the title, The Perfect Weapon, it reminded me of this, maybe it's apocryphal, this Hitchcock story that the perfect weapon was the icicle that you could use to murder somebody because it would then melt and there would be no fingerprints. It seems that it actually is apocryphal. It's apparently a leg of lamb that you use on someone and then you cook it up for those who are investigating and they eat it.
Oh,
so that is the perfect weapon. And it was on a Twilight Zone many, many years ago. Which is the equivalent, today's equivalent of the Twilight Zone of something called Black Mirror.
When we went back to search, as lawyers will make you do, for the previous uses of the perfect weapon, we found a Steven Seagal movie from like 20 years ago or something like that, which is probably a more fun watch than you know.
And was he the perfect weapon, Steven Seagal?
I think he was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure Vladimir Putin will be happy to hear that.
We'll have to see if we can get a picture of him holding the book. You know?
Right. Well, so it brings me to that question of this untraceable reality of this cyber weapon, so that we assume that others have implanted. We know that other nations have implanted into our systems. You have just said we've implanted in multiple systems. But is it something that you can then assign to someone? Is it traceable?
It is traceable, but at different levels of certainty. And you want to be really certain before you retaliate. So think about the Russia hack. Before the U.S. government was really aware of what was going on, a company called CrowdStrike, which is one of the many pretty good cybersecurity firms that are out there, identified this as a Russian intrusion into the DNC. Eventually, the intelligence community came to the same conclusion, but they didn't announce that until about 4 or 5 months later. Similarly, it took 4 or 5 months for the U.S. government to say that the North Koreans did WannaCry and that the Russians did NotPetya, which was an attack against Ukraine. And that raises an interesting question, because if it takes you that long to figure it out, then, you know, 4 months later, what are you going to do? Retaliate in a very strong way for something that was 4 months old and has sort of passed? Your political moment has sort of gone by you. Now, we did do some things against the Russians. President Obama did not want to escalate prior to the election because he was afraid that if he punished the Russians prior to the election, they would come back on election day and actually mess with the voting machines and the process and feed into Donald Trump's argument at the time that the election was rigged. This was when everybody assumed that Hillary Clinton would win and that Trump would then argue that something was wrong in the election system and doubt her legitimacy, or cast doubt on her legitimacy. In that case, the president held back. Eventually, we did punish the Russians in the Obama era. In the last weeks of his administration, they threw out 35 alleged diplomats who were mostly spies and closed a couple of facilities, including one on Long Island where we believe the Russians were digging down and tapping into a big cable underneath their property that was actually a main communications trunk line. But think about this. We threw out diplomats, or as someone in the book is quoted as saying, a member of the Obama administration, we came up with the perfect 19th century response to a 21st century problem. And so we've got to figure out how to update the response in a way that people actually feel that it's going to make a difference. We've indicted Chinese and Iranian hackers. They've never seen the inside of a U.S. courtroom. Now,
Maybe it was partly a deterrent because people might want to be able to travel freely, but I'm not sure that one is sufficient.
Is Trump ignoring the cyber threat? And maybe you can answer this in the following way also, because we just heard that he's asked for the development of a new military division, the Space
Command. Mm-hmm.
Command. We have a cyber, a Space Force, is that what it is? Thank you. We have a cyber
We have U.S. Cyber Command.
The Cyber Command.
Which has just been elevated to be a full command, like Central Command, which does the Mideast, and Northern Command, which protects the United States, right?
So does that give you the sense that, in fact, the president is taking these threats seriously and actually doing something about them?
What worries me is not that this administration doesn't want to build up our cyber capability. It's that they aren't developing a strategy that sort of matches the subtlety and importance of cyber along the way. So they were well on their way. They hired two very talented people at the higher end of the National Security Council to be in the administration. Tom Bossert, who was the Homeland Security advisor and had had some extensive cyber experience during the Bush administration and did some things out in the private sector during Obama's time and came back in. And then they brought in as the White House cyber coordinator a man named Rob Joyce, who had been a career NSA employee, who had run a unit within the NSA that you can read about in the book called the Tailored Access Operations Unit. It was essentially the cyber special forces who break into foreign computer systems when authorized to do so by the president. And that was the first time that that job was held by somebody who was expert in cyber offense as well as defense. I thought that was pretty important. So then John Bolton came in a few months ago. Bossert was gone within 48 hours, I think in part because he had direct access to the president. I think that Bolton wanted to make sure he was controlling the national security access to the president. Rob Joyce eventually left to go back to the NSA, and Mr. Bolton announced that his job was being eliminated. The cyber coordinator job at the White House no longer exists. I assume because he's concluded that we are over-coordinated in the U.S. government when it comes to cyber. So what I worry about is that we are at the moment that this is the number one threat identified by U.S. intelligence to the United States, that we are actually dismantling the sort of central control of thinking about all of these different equities. When you want to do offense, when you don't, what kind of things you might want to give up doing so that you can get the assurance from other countries that they won't do them to us.
Right. I have a question here about methodology, which is, again, something that Professor Sanger may want to answer. Given the secret nature of information relevant to talking about cyber, can you talk about the sources you used and public or research access to these sources?
Sure. So as in all national security reporting, there's a certain amount you can do from public sources. There's a certain amount you can do from budgets. You know, they hide a lot of things in black budgets, but if you know how to go read budgets over time, you can begin to divine where money is being spent. And there's a certain amount you're going to have to do just by going out and interviewing people who are aware of classified programs and finding ways that they can actually talk about it without going to jail. And sometimes that's hard and sometimes that's easy. There's a big section of the book that describes what happened in the leak investigation that followed the last book and caught up a very good man, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General James Cartwright. He had left as vice chairman by the time I was interviewing him, but who had talked to me some about the Iran program and ended up getting caught in the net of a leak investigation when I'm quite convinced that what he was trying to do was keep me from publishing certain things that he believed would be harmful to the U.S. if they got published. I think he was operating from the best of intentions. So it's very tricky business doing this kind of reporting. I'm very careful not to keep notes of really sensitive conversations so that if you actually get subpoenaed for something, you have nothing to turn over. right? And there's a lot of pretty complicated legal issues around this. At the same time, I think it's vitally important that we do this kind of reporting in a responsible way. Because just because the government has determined that they're not ready to go talk about cyber doesn't mean that we're not ready as a country to think hard about how we want to go use it or not. And that's, I think, a vital part of what the founders had in mind when the First Amendment was written. And as I remind people, the First Amendment is first for a reason.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. That's really important. And I think it's important to remind everyone what it is you do and the institution that you represent, which doesn't appear to be failing these days, but is actually doing some hard work.
As we have reminded President Trump on rare occasion, the failing New York Times is not failing in large part because of him.
Mm-hmm. One question here is, and then we'll wrap up the this part of this, is what is the likelihood we will see an accidental triggering of cyber weapons? In the Cold War, we had the red phone and many controls to prevent accidental triggering. What would be the likely result and response?
It's a great question. The opportunities for accidental conflict breaking out because of cyber are even greater than they were in nuclear. And as we move to artificial intelligence-based weapons, the opportunity for such mistakes is only going to increase because the decision time to slow down and say, wait a minute, something here isn't right, is going to go from hours or minutes to milliseconds. A comparison I frequently use in this case comes from one of your colleagues, Marcus, at Stanford.
Mm-hmm. Bill Perry.
Right. Okay. So for those of you, many of you, I'm sure, know Bill. So the defense secretary under President Clinton. But before that, he was an assistant secretary of defense responsible for technology-related issues. And in his wonderful memoir, which Stanford published a few years ago, he tells the story of getting woken up one night by a duty officer who said, "Sir, we think we may know what's going on here, but I have to tell you, we're seeing evidence in the nuclear warning system of scores of Soviet missiles that are launched at us on the way, and we have to decide whether to wake up the president. And by the way, we don't have very much time to go do it." Well, it was not a period of great tension with the Soviet Union. It did not seem like this was the moment that the Soviets would just unleash a bunch of nukes at us and see if they could get away with a preemptive strike. And the more that they studied into this, and they were digging pretty fast, what did they discover? That some idiot had taken a training tape that they would use when you were trying to simulate a nuclear attack and your responses, and put it by mistake in the real system. And so it looked like we were under attack when in fact it was a simulation. Now, there were a few minutes, and by the time they had called Bill, they had pretty well suspected that this was what was going on. But imagine a system in an artificial intelligence era where the system hasn't been programmed to stop and say, does this make any sense given the political environment? And so I think that there is a heightened fear of doing that. There's one other fear. If you think there are implants in your system, you will wonder whether when you press that big red button, if one existed, to launch a nuclear response, whether the system would work. And if you didn't have confidence that it would work, you might try to launch it early to make sure that it worked. So that would make you think you might want to norm against getting inside the command and control system of each other's nuclear programs, which is, of course, exactly what we did against the North Korean missile program. And you know, the back cover of the book describes a scene in which the U.S. tries to do with North Korea what we did with Iran and get inside their missile program to make their missiles during the tests fall into the sea. And for a while, they had an 88% failure rate. Now, we don't know how much of that was because of the
U.S. operation. It could have been because of North Korean mistakes, bad engineering, bad parts, all kinds of reasons. But the fact of the matter is, the missiles were failing. Now, I can see why an American president would want to go use their cyber weapons to try to reduce the North Korean threat, better than starting a war with them. But you're also setting a precedent that missile command and control systems are open game.
Right. Is everyone taking a breath? maybe you have a final word for us?
Well, I'll give you one cheery word out of all of this. We designed all of these systems. We came up with them. So we can come up with the solution to this problem, right? This is not, you know, you all live in California. There are earthquakes. I realize this isn't a newsflash to you. But there's not a whole lot you can do to change the underlying dynamics that cause the earthquakes. All you can try to do is build up resiliency against them. In cyber, we need to build resiliency. We need to certainly be sure that if there's a cyber attack, we have a way of containing it, having backup systems respond to it. And we're getting better at doing that. But the fact of the matter is that because we designed it, we actually have the opportunity to unbuild it. Now, the same is true in nuclear, and you are not seeing a huge amount of effort going right now into reducing that threat, but you did for a while. We had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at us and in the Soviet era, in the height of the Cold War, and we're down to 1,550 on either side deployed right now. That's still a lot. It's plenty to destroy each other and the rest of civilization, but it's a lot better than 12,000 on each side. So it is not an unreasonable task for a generation that's coming along to figure out how to undo the mess that we so neatly built. And I think events like what happened in the Russia hack have had the good effect of making people think about the fact that a technology which we all believed in our naive way was just going to bring about more democratization, which is what Bill Clinton used to say when he'd go to China and say, you know, as the internet comes up, it's going to undercut the Soviet Union, or as the internet comes up, it will undercut the Communist Party in China. To now realizing that this weapon can be used as a weapon. And the question is, can we come up with the ways to limit its effects? We're never going to get rid of all of this. You're never going to get rid of all disease. You're never going to get rid of all traffic accidents. But there are things you can do to make sure that we can survive through them. And that's what I think our next big mission is.
All right, everybody. You got it? David Sanger, The Perfect Weapon is the name of the book. Thank you very much for being with us.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured David Sanger. He's national security correspondent at the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Perfect Weapon. He was in conversation with our co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.